You're listening to This Way Up, a podcast from the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. We are a global NGO with research experts in 23 different countries, pushing for greater human rights accountability in business. In our podcasts, we will outline and interrogate the latest issues related to business and human rights, bringing together diverse expertise from frontline activists, civil society, companies, investors, and academia. In this series, we are partnering with the UN Working Group on Business and Human Rights to mark the 10th anniversary of the UN Guiding Principles and look forward to what the next decade might hold. Over the course of four episodes, we will examine the impact and reach of the UNGPs since they were introduced through a different thematic lens each week. We'll explore the impact, gaps, and opportunities as we look forward to the next 10 years.
Hello, and welcome to This Way Up. I'm Phil Bloomer, Executive Director of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre, and your host for this final episode in our series marking the 10th anniversary of the United Nations Guiding Principles for Business and Human Rights. For this episode, I had the pleasure of being joined by three members of the United Nations Working Group for Business and Human Rights and a live online audience to discuss the vision for the next decade of the Guiding Principles and the role that they should play in supporting a just recovery from the tragedy of the COVID-19 pandemic that we're currently living through. Across the course of the discussion, we covered reflections, opportunities and challenges, as well as taking questions from the virtual floor, all of which we've then edited down into bite-sized form. Before jumping in, I'd like to take a moment to thank the Working Group for their partnership in this whole series and to the audience members who attended this recording. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to our webinar and podcast with the United Nations Working Group members on the Just Recovery and the United Nations Guiding Principles for Business and Human Rights, plus 10. Thanks first to my colleagues at the United Nations Office of the High Commission and the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre who've diligently organised this podcast together. I'm Phil Bloomer, the Executive Director of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre and the moderator today. So let me first introduce our august panel. Anita Ramasastry, member of the UN Working Group and Professor of Law at Washington University in Seattle. Surya Deva, the Vice Chair of the UN Working Group and Associate Professor at the School of Law of City University, Hong Kong. And Dante Pesce, the Chairperson of the UN Working Group and Executive Director of Vincular Center, Chile. Our topic today is the United Nations Guiding Principles for Business and Human Rights and Ideas for a Just Recovery from the Pandemic. The pandemic struck, as we all know, 18 months ago, as we already faced convergent crises of unsustainable levels of inequality and climate breakdown. Much of business response to the pandemic both exposed and exacerbated the inequality of power and wealth in markets, as workers in supply chains were often summarily dismissed, often without pay. It sometimes felt like progress on the United Nations Guiding Principles over the last 10 years was being torn up before our eyes, although things have got significantly better since then. But the pandemic also had other effects. Some companies and investors demonstrated the power of resilience through human rights and environmental due diligence, for instance, and performed better than many who weren't carrying out due diligence of their risks. And the need for nationwide and international responses to the pandemic means that the state is back, and in some countries has found some new assertiveness in upholding the values of our citizens, including in business and human rights, from parties of the centre-left and the centre-right. Equally, in many countries, what were dismissed as low-skill and low-wage workers, from carers to delivery workers, for instance, were transformed to a new esteemed category of essential worker. So today, we are discussing how the United Nations Guiding Principles can inform and guide our just recovery from this pandemic. How can we emerge from this global crisis and avoid returning to the business as usual of hyper-inequality and climate breakdown, and instead take us to new business models that will build greater protection and respect for human rights, leading to future shared prosperity and indeed climate security. So let's move straight to the questions to the panel.
Well, I think, you know, we've all said it's been 10 years since the UN Guiding Principles for Business and Human Rights were agreed by the consensus of nations and business. It was an extraordinary achievement, one that was grounds for substantial celebration because it was it was one of the few times when we've actually got some new international standards on business and human rights. Now, the pandemic, with its worsening inequality and the threat of climate breakdown, have put those principles really to a severe test. So, panel, I'd like to ask for your brief assessment of the effectiveness of the guiding principles in putting human rights at the heart of business over the last decade. And what do you think are the other factors that have helped or hindered the progress in the delivery of those guiding principles? Can I go straight firstly to Dante?
Yes. Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, Phil, and I will be very straight. The effectiveness is still to be proven beyond pioneers. So we do have evidence of pioneers at business, at governments, at coalitions that are actually showing the path, are demonstrating that the guiding principles are useful as a framework, and that are implementing in practice with growing levels of effectiveness. But that is still at the level of pioneers. And we have a long way to go in normalizing what is today the work of few. Also, when we look at the map of the world, those pioneers are disproportionately located in very few jurisdictions, like yours in London, but very, very few other jurisdictions, notably the Global South, where, again, we have examples, they are growing. We have, let's say, experiments that are taking place in different parts of the world, in Pakistan, in South Korea, in my own country, Chile, etc., but very far away from the level of maturity and where we would like to be. But I have to say one thing out of the 10 years anniversary and the stock-taking exercise that, as you said already, has been published last week, is in six languages already, is that today we can say that we are in the context of a half full glass conversation, or it can be a half empty glass conversation, but at least is the same glass. So we accept that we have the same framework, that there are lessons that we are learning from, and those lessons give us a platform to build a shared vision. And when we have a shared vision, we have a much more likely opportunity to be impactful.
Dante is more of the optimist and I'm more of the glass half empty person. But let me talk about the glass being full, or let me use another analogy, which is that it's actually a bit like the guiding principles have become a well-worn, comfortable piece of furniture that's in many people's rooms. And the reason that that's important is, one, at the United Nations, for example, the idea of a business and human rights framework and addressing the role of companies is now accepted, right? That this in a decade is an important piece, and there's still many challenges within the international sphere, but that's important. Secondly, we do see the embedding, and Dante and Surya have talked about this in their own work, of course, policy coherence. We do see the guiding principles in places like the OECD, engagement through the ILO, even through the World Bank, through performance standards and the environment and the safeguards. So what we will see is just this idea of using the guiding principles as a key part of the architecture for human rights and for responsible business conduct. And that's not to be underestimated. And finally, but again, we can talk about this during the discussion in Q&A, it's amazing. And when I joined the working group a number of years ago, I would never believe that we would be at a place now of focusing more on the mandatory, moving from the voluntary, which the working group has stated has not worked, but to mandatory regulation and mandatory human rights due diligence, especially in the European context. So that is, I think, a very fast and very unique piece that we have to look at. The question, of course, is, will the regulations be effective? Is Pillar 2 by itself enough? My answer is no. And are we actually seeing a bit of fragmentation at the moment with all of these 1,000 regulatory models blooming at the same time? So I'll leave it for there and say, Dante, yeah, the glass is the same glass, and I'll use the furniture analogy to say, yes, the guiding principles are now a comfy sofa.
Great, thank you very much. So we've had glassware, we've had furniture. Surya, over to you.
Thank you. Yes, I think I would say we have a common language now, but if we dig a little deeper, we may still mean different things. So people may talk about human rights due diligence, same language, but what it means in practice, I would say it is very, very different. And that is getting exposed when we're talking about mandatory human rights due diligence legislation, because different stakeholders are expecting and wanting that law to do something different. So I think that is something very much there. I would say the most crucial contribution of UN guiding principles is, in my view, that they have taken out of the equation the question that should businesses respect human rights or no. That question is not part of the discussion anymore. Everyone accepts that businesses have a responsibility to respect human rights, period. So I think that question is not being discussed anymore. What is the nature and extent of those responsibilities, how to enforce them, what is the smart mix and all this? These debates will continue. They are far from settled. And I think 10 years is perhaps a short period to discuss these larger questions. But I think the key, as I mentioned, is the common language that we have a starting point when we are able to have this conversation. That is definitely quite significant. My last point for now is that the uptake of the UN guiding principles is unprecedented in the UN system. But I would add a footnote that the uptake on paper is unprecedented. Uptake in practice is not unprecedented, because in practice, the uptake is, there's a wide gap. Let me put it this way. There's a wide gap between paper and practice, both on the part of the governments. Like many governments, like 25, if I remember correctly, have standalone nation action plans now. So if you look at that, that is a paper. If you look at the practice, what the governments have done, they have been regression as well. So same applies to businesses. Many businesses are saying it on their websites, in their reports, they're committed to UN guiding principles. In practice, has it made an impact on the rights holders on the ground? I very much doubt. So I think it's a mixed picture. But the crucial thing is, as I think three of us are acknowledging, that we're talking about perhaps a common framework which could lead us somewhere. Whether that somewhere is going to be good enough or not, I don't know.
Thank you very much, Surya. Could I come back to you, Dante, and just ask, you were glass half full at the start. Where would you say that you've seen the strengths of the guiding principles really play out for the benefit of poor and vulnerable people? And, you know, what are the features that have made them a real force for human rights?
Well, I will say that one of the findings of our report is the lack of data.
Right.
And the lack of evidence that is consistent and is comparable. So we have examples, let's say the Bangladesh Accord, or we have examples in sectors where the palm oil or cocoa, yeah. Or in some industries that have developed much more robust frameworks for their local engagement, including indigenous people, like in the extractive industry. So yes, I can go through examples, and of course, in my region, Latin America, I know firsthand a number of them. Let's say sharing property rights on an extractive industry with indigenous people. Which is unthinkable. It was unthinkable 2-3 years ago. And certainly, we have a lot of anecdotes that we can go through, but systematic change on the ground that can last beyond the goodwill or the good intentions that take place here or there, I couldn't say that is still the case. I would like it to be, and to be transformational, and I think the guiding principles have the potential to help drive transformation in business models, for example.
Yeah.
But we're not there yet. We are experimenting, or business are experimenting in some governments. Let's say the covenants in the Netherlands. You know, that has a great potential, but still is potential with anecdotal cases and progress that is being made, but with significant pushbacks. Let's say the CEO of Danone recently, actually moving his company in the very right direction and then having to resign. And that took place 2 months ago, a big blow to what you could consider to be the exercise of leadership. So it's to be seen. But I think the regulatory wave that is taking place in Western Europe and the role of investors that actually we published last week, a 40 pages analysis on the investors, show that we do have great potential. And if there is something coherent coming out of regulation that can make sense for normal people, let's say, to be implemented, of course that has great potential. I will say my own experience in Latin America, our business people are in general not ahead of the curve. our business people, they wait and see, but they are very pragmatic. So if the market pushes you in a new direction, there's going to be some resistance. But if the new direction comes both from regulation and investors or the market itself, that's going to have an impact. And there are a number of examples where this combination between expectations from the investors and market regulation has actually played well. On the environmental side, right, for example, has played well. And in the area of anti-corruption and transparency has played well. So there are examples where we can piggyback that show that a consistent approach over years with the right balance between the measures and the political will can actually work.
Thank you. Just a couple of words, please, from Anita and Surya. On the flip side to that, what are the areas of least progress in the guiding principles that we really need to be alert to now that may hinder advances in the just recovery in the next decade?
I'll just talk about pillar one, the role of the state. The working group has spoken out about responsible recovery and how the guiding principles are kind of an essential ingredient, which is really about the government when it provides support to business, whether it's loans, bailouts, procurement opportunities, needs to ensure that it's rights respecting, right? That you should be asking companies to demonstrate adherence to the guiding principles, but more generally, just respect for human rights. That hasn't happened before the pandemic and certainly didn't happen during the pandemic. So I'd say that's still a big shortcoming. So we have national action plans and we have regulation, but we don't have that larger coherence, which is about the state using all of its levers to really bring companies to the right place. And I'll just add one other thing about, you know, did the guiding principles help companies during the pandemic? The only thing I'll say there, and there's some interesting studies from Just Capital and from Stanford and others just saying that it's what we should expect. So we shouldn't be congratulating companies for doing the right thing and treating workers and people with dignity during a major crisis. But companies that either adhered to the guiding principles and knew how to conduct due diligence, or companies that had strong programs on worker welfare, were the ones that did actually take the right actions during the pandemic. So just to say that embedding that kind of process into your thinking, I think, is essential to recovery.
I will add, as Anita hinted, when it comes to access to remedial corporate accountability, I think the progress has almost not been there because of the pillar three, I would say. There have been some interesting cases in the UK, in the Netherlands. One recent case on climate change explicitly makes a reference to UN guiding principles, but the UN guiding principles were not the basis of that case. Then there's an interesting case in Canada and elsewhere. So there are some positive developments, patches of progress, but I would not say they are because of pillar three. So I think this gap is very, very significant. If you look at the data, and I think the Resource Center compiles data, if you look at the attacks on the human rights defenders, I think the attacks have not reduced in the last 10 years. Probably they have gone up. Or it is that we are documenting them better. I don't know. In either way, it seems there is no positive impact on reducing the attacks in the civic space. And the working group, again, under the leadership of Anita, issued the guidance last week on that. So let us see if that guidance is implemented by states. Because we can only persuade the states and businesses to do ABC. But ultimately, they have to do that ABC. And unless they do that, I think things will remain very, very difficult. My last point for now is informal economy. I think we have not paid enough attention. Perhaps even the working group has not paid enough attention to informal economy and SMEs. If you look at the Global South in particular, there are significant players who are part of the informal economy. They are not even aware of the UN guiding principles. Forget about the implementation. They don't even know that UNGPs exist, most of these players. So how do we bring them inside the tent? I think that is going to be a big challenge. Unless we bring them inside the tent, I think the challenge is going to be very, very limited. We can't just focus on multinationals and their supply chains.
Thank you very much, Surya. And let me continue with you for a moment. But if we look now, turn our vision towards the next decade, you know, how can the UN guiding principles really help in the endeavor to transform business models? How can they be implemented, strengthened, adapted, challenged at the national, regional, and global levels to really speed action on inequality, on abuse, and climate breakdown? What would be, you know, for you, the two or three things that really need to happen to make the UN guiding principles become that very powerful lever that we all need if we're going to get human rights at the heart of business?
I think human rights due diligence definitely has the potential to bring a systemic change. But so far, I'm not very optimistic that it has been able to do that. In many cases, we see the tick box exercise. We have not been able to shift the corporate culture, let me put it this way. And changing a culture of any organization is a slow process. It takes time. So perhaps 10 years is not enough. But I think we need to change this mindset that we have to keep the rights and rights holders at the center. In fact, I often say pillar two should be about not companies. Pillar two is about rights holders, because that is rights holders who suffer impact. So if businesses continue to adopt a legalistic top-down model of human rights due diligence, that will not make impact positively on the rights holders on the ground. But hopefully, with the guidance that we are providing, with the realization, hopefully some companies at least will understand and they will try to do some positive evaluation and modification in the due diligence process, because that is part of peer learning as well. My second point would be that going forward, we should not think that UNGPs will solve all the challenges in the world. They cannot. No instrument can solve all the challenges. So I think we would need to develop, I would say, more ambitious norms in the business and human rights field. And I'm not intentionally saying binding. Binding is a separate issue. I'm talking about more ambitious, because it is quite possible that businesses and states can implement UN guiding principles, but the level of inequality may remain. Because we have an economic model in which the chief executive officer of a company, he or she earns, mostly he, earns 800 times more than the average salary of a worker. So that company can do due diligence day in, day out, but that inequality will remain. We have tobacco companies claiming that they respect UN guiding principles. To me, that is just not acceptable to me. How can a tobacco company respect UN guiding principles? Because even if they remove child labor from their supply chain, right to health, right to life is at stake. So, I mean, colleagues may have a different view, but that's my personal view. Gig economy workers, those models are fundamentally based on exploitation. How can due diligence fix those challenges? So I think I would say we need to implement better the UN guiding principles in the letter and the spirit. But I would also say that we need to go beyond the UN guiding principles and think of challenging the structures of imbalance and power and injustice that are there with us.
Thank you. When you say that going beyond the guiding principles in terms of that addressing those fundamental inequalities of power and wealth, and income, as you've just highlighted, what would be the one or two things that you believe would make a fundamental difference in changing those inequalities beyond the guiding principles? Are there things that you think the next generation, if you like, of the guiding principles must really now emphasize?
I would say we need to focus on the outcomes. Due diligence is a process. Companies have to be held accountable as a matter of a strict liability. Let us take a simple example. If a smartphone company, there is something wrong in the battery and a consumer is hurt, that company is absolutely liable for that injury caused to the consumer. The company cannot take this as a defense. Oh, we don't know who manufactured this battery or this particular component of the smartphone. But when it comes to human rights abuses, this very same supply chains become very complex. And they say, oh, we cannot be responsible for that. So I think we need to focus on the outcomes in some cases. And that's where the strict liability could become quite relevant. I would also say that we need to draw some red lines, that these activities are not allowed. Because human rights due diligence may give an impression, I would say false impression, that as long as you do due diligence, this is fine. You are acting in compliance with UN guiding principles. And I think we need to question that false assumption. I would say taxation is a big thing. We need to address this, the inequality in the wealth. Because how come we allow some people to become extremely rich, even in the times of pandemic, right? So I think we need to fix those fundamental issues.
Thank you very much, Surya. That's great. Moving now to Anita. Could you just briefly again describe from your perspective, what you see as the key ways in which the UN guiding principles can really help in that endeavor to transform business models, making them fit for purpose for the next decade and these extraordinary challenges that we have before us?
Well, I think, again, we need to build with them and then build beyond them, as Surya said. So a couple of points. One is, and I know there's been lots of discussion, you know, in the U.S., for example, around the role of corporations in the political sphere. And this is something that we need to tackle. We refer to it in the business and human rights space as corporate capture. But I want to say there are three dimensions to this. And so the guiding principles, I think we can use them to say there's inconsistency in the way in which corporations operate in the political sphere versus their commitments to human rights. But then we need to go beyond the guiding principles to think about solutions. So companies, when they lobby, both nationally, regionally, and globally, are often acting inconsistently with their commitment to the guiding principles and human rights when they provide finance to politicians, and even when they choose to speak up or not to speak up on certain issues. And so, again, I think this is a very big issue. And until we look at the role of corporations and their political leverage, we won't be able to move forward as fully. A second point is about leverage, and I think the big challenge that we're seeing in very complex and difficult environments. There are situations where there are human rights abuses and impacts everywhere in the world, every market, every place, but there are also situations where states are the ones actively perpetrating the human rights abuses. And in those situations where there may also be conflict and repression, there's a real question about, well, how far can the guiding principles take us beyond saying, use your leverage, but there probably won't be any if the government is really controlling and saying, well, it doesn't matter to us. So is responsible exit the only alternative, or what can we do and what are the collective strategies? I think we're sort of pushing the boundaries there, and we need to look for answers to those questions. And then the third thing is just to agree with Surya. Our report, our stocktaking report, talks about the engagement with rights holders. And it's not about a sort of north-south view where someone from a company designs a due diligence model thinking they know what questions should be asked of a rights holder. But in my field, again, in terms of scholarship and research, we need to take an anti-colonial approach, which is really about, we don't know the questions to ask. We need to basically really listen and begin by understanding what other people and rights holders have to say back to the companies. And this is going to be a very, very big challenge, I think, for all of us.
That's so interesting. And I was just reading our draft report that's out very soon on hotels in Qatar, ready for the World Cup, and the way in which, you know, there's literally two or three of the major international hotel brands that have made an effort to really speak to workers. And of course, what has come out for them is a whole host of the issues that they really now understand and can start to tackle, whereas the other, you know, 17 or so really paid no attention to the workers, thought they could just do it on their own, and then have ended up not understanding really some of the greatest driving forces of forced labor in some of their managed hotels. So it's very interesting what you say. Thanks very much. And then, Dante, over to you.
I will say, across the board, what I see is the lack or not lack of political will. If you want to do things better, you can. If you want to know, you can. Maybe it will be imperfect, but if you have the right, let's say, mindset, and you really, and my answer will be, it's difficult to know. Well, try harder. This is a complicated path. Well, do it again and give it a try again, because it is possible, but also it has to be possible. It has to be if we want to live in a future with less conflict than more conflict, that is sustainable for all and the future generations. So that's one thing. The political will element is across the board. And that has to be, let's say, connected with incentives and consequences for not doing what is right or what is mandatory. And the right set of incentives, I will say, in general, are not there. The reward for short-termism vis-a-vis long-term is 99-1. Yeah, so you get a huge bonus if you're completely short-term and you have nothing except being fired if you move your company in the direction of long-term for the vast majority of companies.
Yeah.
So how can you expect that someone in its right mind will do something completely against it in its personal interest? Difficult. Yeah, you have to be a bit of a hero or a saint to do that in most cases. So I will say, taking advantage of the changing context, especially in Europe, not only in Europe, of the legal framework, and developing also the consequences of not complying. That is, so avoiding the free riders, etc., or limiting their capacity to do whatever they want. I think that's important. And I think in Europe, with the Sustainable Corporate Governance Initiative, the new financial directive, or the coming new one, and of course the due diligence framework. I saw a report from Ernst & Young with something like 300 plus policy initiatives in the context of Europe linked to sustainability or corporate sustainability. So that's a big wave moving in that direction. So that's important. And the other thing that I would like to come back is to, in February 2011, in the context of the negotiation of the guiding principles, when they were going to be endorsed unanimously by the Human Rights Council, there was a report issued in February 2011. So a few months before the guiding principles were agreed. And that was led by Professor Raggi too, with three main objectives, the policy objectives. One was to organize an annual forum and to have a stock-taking exercise on an annual basis to learn from what we were doing, with an expectation of about 300 people a year gathering in Geneva or somewhere else to learn from each other. Today, we have that but like 10 times, but also we have the peer learning exercises taking places in other parts of the world. The stock-taking is actually happening way beyond expected, which is good. The second element was unpacking the principles, because many of the principles were a title, but not really with enough detail. What does it mean? And we have been doing at the working group many reports that are meant to unpack the principles. So we have been making progress regarding the unpacking and adding more clarity in those principles that were just, let's say, a few paragraphs, but really, really very generic, not clear enough. And the third element, which is missing almost completely, is a massive capacity building effort to build the infrastructure and the capacity among all stakeholders to be part of this effort. And that is something that has been greatly missed. There was the idea to create a trust fund by governments. That never happened, to be able to consistently and systematically help build the capacity and the needed infrastructure everywhere in the world. We have some projects here and there, but nothing really systematic. And of the three proposals presented in February 2011, that was the one that is missing for the most part. And that is one of the points that we show in when we look at into the future in the report of the stock taking, is capacity building, building the infrastructure, and also around the power sharing, where we have powerful and powerless. And how can you sit on the same table if you are in a complete unbalanced relation?
Great. Do you see this issue of the repurposing of the corporation as an area where we've got to, find new ways in which we can define what the purpose of the corporation is? And are there ways in which corporate law needs to be adjusted to make that very clear?
When it comes to corporate law, there are many things that must change. I would say that the corporations would have to become more democratic. We do not have seats in the board of directors of the companies. They are taking decisions which are impacting all of us, but we have no say in those decision-making processes, right? So I think making corporations more democratic, transparent institutions, perhaps smaller institutions, I would say, maybe more sustainable, better for us. And of course, we need to deal with the big hurdles in relation to access to remedy, the principles of separate personality and limited liability. These are big, big barriers when it comes to Pillar 3. And I think that's why corporate law reform is absolutely vital. And this is identified in principle UNGPs already. If you look at Principle 3, it is already mentioned there. But I think we need to develop those fine nuances that how that reform should take place going forward.
And is there any area that you would want to just emphasize briefly on the move from the short-term quarterly demands of shareholders to a much longer-term arc?
One thing is, if you look at the World Bank's ease of doing business index, that is highly problematic. Because that index encourages governments to go to the race to the bottom. They keep on lowering their standards on labor rights, human rights, environmental pollution. So I think that is highly problematic. Then there are, of course, these pressures on the directors and the chief executive officers to deliver quarterly. And I think they also have a conflict of interest. The higher the share price, the more money they make. So can we de-link this, right? The salary and the rewards that the directors are getting, I think that is another issue that we need to look at. And I think that is where I'm saying that we need to make these institutions, corporations more democratic.
So let's move now to that last section on models of change. How do we get, how, you know, it's one thing to be able to do what you've just done, provide a really inspiring and ambitious broad vision for the transformation of business models that are going to protect and strengthen human rights in business, address inequality of power and wealth in markets. But there are lots of opportunities, threats, and challenges about how that can be achieved in our societies. Could I just ask each of you, you know, what, starting with Anita, what are the core strategies you believe will play a vital role in achieving these goals? And who are the actors that will be the champions? Who do you see as the blockers? And who do we need to persuade to come into this broad vision and strategy?
Wow, that's a big question, Phil. I'll try to take part of it. And again, you know, we all sort of fall back on what we know. And my work and career started in anti-corruption. So what I do see there, and if we looked at the trajectory from sort of the U.S. dealing with foreign bribery all the way through from the OECD to a U.N. convention against corruption, and at least a global consensus that corruption is wrong, we haven't solved that problem, but is the partnership and leadership of companies with civil society. And we may start to see more of this in the business and human rights space now that we have mandatory human rights due diligence on the horizon, that once you have a coalition of willing companies, mainly because they're often dragged to the table, but then they become champions, right? Once they're regulated, they want to level the playing field globally. But I think that this is essential, right? That we need these strong collective coalitions of business and civil society working together in order for there to be change. So that would be one of the things I would say that I think is critical to this area and movement.
That's great. So, Surya, what would you say were the big opportunities in terms of the core strategies that we can, that we need to deploy now to get these kind of inspiring and ambitious visions over the line?
I will say we need to build bottom-up strategies. We need to come out of the Geneva bubble, I would say, because the change has to be on the ground. It has to be different in different countries, in different industries and all this. And I would say some of the Global South strategies should be at the forefront. We recently did a report on National Human Rights Institutions. And it was quite striking that the Global South NHRIs are doing much more ambitious work on business and human rights as compared to the Global North. So we have to not always drive the BHR agenda from the Global North perspective. We have to look at what may work better in the Global South, based on the conditions, are their experiences unique and different? And what strategies bottom-up could be developed from there to bring this change? The second thing that I would like to mention is that BHR agenda has to be part of the political processes in all countries at all levels. So the elections must be contested and fought on this manifesto of business and human rights. What will you do to workers? What will you do to deal with poverty and climate change issues and all this? Because unless we build, because all three of us are saying there is lack of political will, right? So one solution could be, oh, there is no political will. Let us ask businesses to do it. But my response is that if pillar one fails, UNGPs will fail. Completely, they will fail, in my view. So states remain very critical players, not only to act themselves, but also create a signal in the market. And that's where we need to recover the state. And how do you recover the state, which has been lost, in my view, in the free market economy? Through the political process. And that's where the rights holders, trade unions, students, academia, lawyers, the grassroots movements, I think they would have a critical role to play going forward. And I think that is where, hopefully, the guidance that Anita developed as part of due diligence for human rights defenders, I think those kind of things have to be paid greater attention, in my view.
Can you point to any examples that you've seen that where that is at least partially coming alive, or areas where governments are starting to insist on an approach that approximates to that?
Unfortunately, no. At least I'm not aware that the governments are insisting that. But I think the resistance on the part of the grassroots movements is definitely opening some eyes of some companies, because the projects can't go ahead, the issue of social licenses there. And I think that may hopefully compel more companies and more governments to open their eyes and develop a different kind of a model of development.
Very interesting. I mean, from my perspective, just, you know, the work that we've been doing on renewable energy, where there's so many deep concerns about some of the policy and practice of some of the renewable energy companies, and indeed transition mineral extracting companies.
That is the problem that we are talking about now, battery operated cars. To me, they are not the solution. They are part of the problem. As plastic bags were created as a solution 30 years back, now we are trying to get rid of them because plastic bags are a problem. I see battery operated cars, we are promoting them like anything. They could become part of the problem 20 years from now, because from where we'll get the minerals? How do we dispose of the batteries? So we need to encourage people to buy less cars and develop better public transport rather than encouraging battery operated cars. So, I mean, this is a fundamental shift that I'm talking about.
I mean, I think my point was going to be more about, you know, there's going to be, whether they're used for major public transport or other, or for renewable energy through other means, for other purposes, domestic purposes. But the key thing is that if you look at the Canadian and New Zealand experience where Indigenous people have been granted their land, you actually have a situation where the company has to negotiate with the community about installations, whether it's geothermal in New Zealand or wind and solar in Canada, because the communities own that land, and therefore there's a much greater equality of negotiation. And of course, you get much more stable deals between both the community and the company. I'm going to take us now into the Q&A. Firstly, Krishnendu, thank you very much for your question. Very pertinent, and one that we should have perhaps addressed already, but haven't. We've only just mentioned investors. ESG is gaining momentum amongst those who advise businesses. Is that good for the implementation of the UNGPs, or is it simply greenwash, or a bit of both, could I add? Anita, could I ask you to start us off?
Sure. In terms of ESG is gaining momentum among those who advise businesses, right? Is this good? In theory, yes. The working group did just release our investor guidance as part of the Next Decade project, and we really believe that there's a lot of tremendous leverage there among mainstream institutional investors if used. The problem that our report highlighted, though, is that at the moment, there's just, again, as Dante mentioned, really just no real metrics for what is good data. At the moment, companies are rated or scored by data providers based on, in terms of ESG, you know, what processes they have, right? It's just about on paper, do they have policies? Do they say they conduct human rights due diligence? Do they adhere to the guiding principles? But there aren't outcomes-based data. Just a couple of days ago, actually, the Norwegian Pension Fund has issued a tender for what they're calling a better data initiative, because they do want to start tracking and assessing when companies are implicated in human rights abuses, right? So actually measuring, I mean, it'd be good to measure impact that's positive, but in the meanwhile, measuring impact that is negative in terms of not rewarding companies that have a poor record. So I think Krishnendu's question is excellent. We need to move forward with better data and assess what companies are doing, not what they're saying.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Gwendolyn, for your question. Do we need specific targets on outcomes beyond the sustainable development goals for business and human rights sphere to paint a clearer picture of the vision that we seek? And could the treaty process be reshaped in that direction?
I think we need these outcomes. Let us say living wage. Living wage is an outcome, right? So we can impose those obligations rather than merely saying that businesses need to do due diligence to ensure that the workers' rights are protected, right? Do we have independent trade unions? That could be an outcome. Do we have gender parity in terms of the pay, in terms of the managers in companies and senior positions, right? So I think these are the outcomes. They can be negotiated industry-wide, or they can be negotiated at each country level and all this. And I think those outcomes are very, very crucial. And then businesses must be able to achieve those outcomes, otherwise they should be accountable. Regarding the treaty process, I very much doubt, because treaties at the international level generally are very broad. They will not set such outcomes, especially in the business and human rights field where there is a lack of political will. So I will not put too much hope on the treaty setting these outcomes that could be achieved. That's why I when I say is we need more ambitious. I was not referring to the treaty, because treaty may not be ambitious. So we need more ambitious norms, and those can be developed bottom up.
Suna Thorsen, thanks for your question. Does the panel see single rights issues, such as the modern slavery act, if you like, single issue due diligence, or single country due diligence, which is the second question, as a step forward or as a step backwards? So if we're looking at, say, what France and Germany have done, or what Britain has done on modern slavery, what the Dutch have done on the issue of child labour, which may well be expanded, what has happened in terms of the Tariff Act in the United States, in terms of the impounding of goods at port around modern slavery, are they steps on the road to something more systemic, or are they blocks on the road to somewhere more systemic?
I can take this sort of because I come from a jurisdiction, you know, the common law jurisdictions are the modern slavery jurisdictions at the moment, Australia, UK, Canada. I think what we need to do is actually look hard and say, is it possible to move from these single issue regimes into mandatory human rights due diligence? What will it look like to retrofit? Is it possible? So that's one thing just to say, I think that's a question that needs to be explored now. But the second question we need to look at is, do we need to throw out all of those regulatory processes, or are there things we can learn from and should keep as well? Right? That, as you mentioned, Phil, you know, the use of customs and trade enforcement, you know, in the US, but increasingly in other jurisdictions, including within the European Union, as a way to address forced labor. Maybe those types of targeted actions are still very important and should be used as a complement to human rights due diligence.
Thanks. And if I could just add one small reflection of my own, I think those remarks really sum up a lot of the opportunities and the dangers, particularly for civil society. You know, it's very easy for civil society to look at these issues really as wedge issues. I think that's a very effective way of looking, you know, what modern slavery in a sense is the thin end of a broader wedge. And because the sharp end of that wedge is emotionally engaging, or such as modern slavery, it can allow civil society to speak to the broad citizenship of a country about the need for action. But it equally contains the danger that an action on modern slavery becomes the end in itself, rather than the sharp edge of a much more transformative agenda, which we need to generate these new business models. So that's there's always a threat and a opportunity in each of these areas. But thanks very much for those answers.
I can briefly add that if those single issue statute or focusing on certain companies, the big size companies and all that, I think they can be a good step if they're part of a broader process, because not everything can be fixed overnight, right? So if the government says, okay, look, that is where we want to reach, and that is where we are starting, and we are learning and we'll keep revising it, then it is fine. But if the Modern Slavery Act becomes the end goal, and then we are not going to go anywhere and we are not going to improve it, then it is highly problematic. Because let us say Australia. The government promised they will draft a national action plan. What they ended with is a modern slavery act, and it seems they're not moving ahead of that. That is problematic. So it depends. If it is part of a wider change, one step at a time, that is fine. If it is the step and that's it, then it is highly problematic. It's counterproductive then.
Great. So I'm going to move us to the question from Sunny, and it's a personal question to Anita and Surya, so let's get personal. But very briefly, if you would. Is it difficult to be part of the UN working group with the mandate to promote the guiding principles if you know that the guiding principles have real difficulties in delivering?
I think it's not difficult, because no single thing can fix everything, right? So UNGPs have the potential, but they also have the limitations. I consider myself as a critical friend of all regulatory initiatives, whether it's a global compact, whether ILO declaration, UNGPs, treaty, whatever. It does not matter, because these are means for me. These are not the end. And when I joined the working group, my objective was to strengthen the UNGPs from the inside. So I think gender perspective was very weak in UN guiding principles. So we did a report on that and tried to strengthen, provide the guidance. So I think that has been my approach. As an outsider, I was critiquing the UN guiding principles. The idea was to improve them, right? So as a member of the working group, I'm trying to improve them from the inside.
Yeah, And I agree. And again, I'm a pessimist by nature. Again, I've been dealing with corruption in my career, and I think I'll end my career and there'll still be lots of corruption. But the larger issue is, I think, where we began this conversation. We're all looking at the same glass. And even as Surya points out, we're not seeing the same language. We do have a framework and we do have a way of talking about how rights holders are at the center, should be at the center, and that respect for human rights is the expectation for businesses everywhere, across jurisdictions. And that's the important power of them, is that normative framework. So I think that's what we as working group members spend our time doing, is really engaging with stakeholders with this common framework. And as Surya said, we then work to strengthen it, to say, what else can we do to enhance the understanding and meaning of the guiding principles? So Surya mentioned, we'll be releasing just in the next couple of weeks, guidance focusing on how states and business should address risks to human rights defenders. And so, again, it's just a way of saying, here are the issues that we need to really focus on and prioritize.
Thanks very much for those honest answers. Anita, any final remarks from you?
I'll just pose actually a more existential comment. As I look at all of the different people who are participating today, many of us, to some extent, actually make a living from business and human rights. We're engaged in the business of business and human rights, either as consultants, as members that work in civil society, as academics. And back to Surya's point, I don't know if we always put rights holders first in the decisions we make and how we engage, and precisely when we are actually benefiting from being engaged in this field. So this is, I think, just the larger issue of the ethical considerations around we engage in the business and human rights. This is something that we all need to think about on a daily basis.
Yeah, a great point, and one that really must resonate, I think, fully through our whole movement, the very diverse and broad movement that we are. Surya, could I come to you for any final remarks?
Thank you. I think I will just make two points. One is that I think we should try to bring at more fundamental changes to the very idea of development. Because this idea of economic growth, which keeps on going, and companies promote consumers to buy more and more, the countries are trying to increase their GDP and all this. So I think this idea of economic growth is not sustainable. So we should see business and human rights as part of this landscape. And I think we need to fix this whole model of economic growth development, which is there. My second point would be that let us talk about more futuristic issues going forward, right? We have not today talked about enough about climate change, in my view. We have not talked about enough about the new technologies, automation, how automation is going to change us, how artificial intelligence and algorithm and big data is going to impact all of us, right? How the surveillance technologies by companies and states are going to change our lives and all this. So I think we need to look at the futuristic issues, next 10 years, next 20 years, next 30 years. And I think if we start thinking about those issues now, it may be better. Otherwise, we will always be lagging behind and just catching up.
Listen, I just want to thank all three of you really for the time that you've spent with us. I know you're extremely busy people. I want to thank all the people that have joined the webinar, and I hope the people who will listen to the podcast, this will be going out in the next week as a podcast on the series. I think it's an extraordinary way to celebrate the UN guiding principles, the achievement of that 10 years ago. And now also looking out and respecting them in the sense of looking out and going beyond them into the future with the extraordinary challenges, but also the opportunities that we face to make a profound difference together as a broad and diverse movement. But really emphasizing that point that's been made by you all, which is that need for us to really put the rights holders at the center of our movement. So with that, I just want to thank everyone again for your work, for the people who've been working behind the scenes in particular to make all this work for all of us. And we'll end there. Thanks very much to all of you. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to This Way Up from the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at BHRRC and let us know what you think. Please keep tuning in. If you like what you hear, share on your network.